Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello, this is the September 2009 edition of the Chemistry World Podcast with Phil Broadwith, Matt Wilkinson, Tom Bond and Nina Notman. In this month's show, is it a liquid? Is it a solid? No, it's a protein and one with some pretty spectacular properties too.
The key thing is that these proteins no longer need to be dissolved in any kind of solvent. They become a solvent themselves. They're actually very good solvents because they behave very similarly to ionic liquids. The great thing about using proteins as these ionic solvents is that you can combine the activity of the protein with that. So if you take a protein such as hemoglobin, you could use it to deliver oxygen in a wound healing kind of scenario.
Reaches the wounds that other proteins just can't penetrate. Phil Broadwith will be here with more on liquid proteins in just a moment. Also on the way, reacting to controversial chemistry. Is this the first example of a trial by Blog?
The starting materials, the raw compounds that we're working with, they're very common, and I guessed that we might have some in our small chemical store. And the technique they use is really simple. And I must admit that the reaction was going on before I thought, hang on, is this a good idea? But by that point, I'd started writing about it and what I'd actually conducted in the lab in my blog.
That's medicinal chemist Paul Doherty, who joins us later to explain how his web writings have helped to shed some light on a very strange chemical reaction. We've also got some news of a novel way to grab bacteria.
What they've done is created some sticky nanotubes which can trap bacteria like flypaper, and they're able to bind specifically to different types of target molecules. When the aptamer is bound to the bacteria, it peels away from the nanotube, and this causes a change in conductivity.
And that change in conductivity can be used to work out how many bacteria there actually are in there. And Tom Bond will join us shortly to explain how it works in a bit more detail. Hello, I'm Chris Smith. Welcome to Chemistry World.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
First this month to the polymer that makes life possible, the protein. But these normally need to be dissolved in something, such as water, to make them work. But now researchers have managed to do something fairly spectacular with them, Phil.
Well, Chris, these proteins are actually liquids, which is very unusual for proteins. Normally proteins we see as very highly ordered structures, and they're quite often solids when we isolate them. But what Steve Mann from Bristol and Helmut Kulfen from Gulm in Germany have done is modify the proteins so that they will stay in a liquid state.
And pray tell us, how do you do that?
Well, what they've done is made some modifications to the surface of the protein to make it positively charged. Then they take negatively charged polymer chains and through an electrostatic interaction stick those polymer chains on the outside so that they make a sort of furry protein that's got these polymer chains sticking out all over it.
And what do the polymer chains actually do? What's their role?
They allow the individual protein molecules to interact with each other, but over a much longer length scale. So they don't ever get close and pack together. They're held apart to keep the whole thing liquid.
So once it actually is behaving as a liquid, what could you do with this? Why is this important?
The key thing is that these proteins no longer need to be dissolved in any kind of solvent. They become a solvent themselves. They're actually very good solvents because they behave very similarly to ionic liquids, which are a new class of solvents which have been widely touted as very green. They can dissolve a wide variety of different things. The great thing about using proteins as these ionic solvents is that you can combine the activity of the protein with that. So if you take a protein such as hemoglobin, which is one of the ones that they've already modified, you could use it to deliver oxygen in a wound healing kind of scenario. Or you could use a catalytic enzyme so that your solvent is also your catalyst.
Are these things actually practical to make? Could you make this in large enough amounts to produce a reasonable quantity that would be useful? Or are they kind of microgram quantities going to be a little while yet?
I think this is just a very early stage at the moment. It's just a proof of concept. They have done it on a variety of different enzymes, including ferritin and hemoglobin and myoglobin, and also lysozyme, which is a catalytic enzyme from egg whites.
Fantastic. Well, we look forward to seeing some applications of that. Runny proteins. And I thought it was just my eggs that were like that. Thank you, Phil. Now, Nina, from runny eggs to nanoparticles, and actually now you're going to go sub-nano. Researchers are saying that size is very important on the small scale.
So Japanese researchers have designed some sub-nano-sized platinum catalysts for use in fuel cells. This work's important because platinum supply is becoming limited and it's also expensive. So smaller amounts of platinum in our catalyst means that financially our fuel cells should be cheaper.
So size is important. We want to go smaller. What size are the present catalysts then, the surfaces we have in, say, the average car exhaust pipe at the moment?
So the average ones at the moment are 2 to 5 nanometres, and conventional wisdom says that 3 nanometres is the best compromise between platinum usage and catalytic activity.
And what's the sub-nano regime then? How big's that?
It's actually down to 12 atoms.
But, OK, so we're down at 12 atom size. How did they show that that's the critical size, and why is that important?
They were looking at different sizes, and they showed that the smaller you went, the higher the catalytic activity was, which wasn't what was expected. And at 12 atom size, they worked out that that had 13 times the activity of commercially available catalysts, which normally have hundreds to thousands of atoms within them. This is particularly interesting because it's not actually due to the surface area that these small catalysts are particularly active.
Oh, right. So just because you've made them smaller and got the individual particle size more, therefore having a bigger surface area to volume ratio, you can't explain the activity on that basis then?
No, the activity is far too high to be explained just by surface area only. And they're saying.
So what are the things going on?
They think it's due to quantum effects, and they're not speculating yet on what those are. They're still trying to work them out.
Sounds a bit of a get-out clause to me.
Me too.
I wonder how long it will take the advertising industry to jump on the sub-nano angle as a selling point. I bet you shampoos and sun creams come first. Thank you, Nina. Most people appreciate the massive impact that the internet has had on the pace and process of scientific discovery. But things have now got even more interesting with the rise of the blogger. Paul Doherty.
I've been working as a medicinal chemist for about 2 years now, and prior to that I was doing my PhD. And during the course of my PhD, I started writing a blog about total synthesis of organic molecules. Initially, and very briefly, anonymously, but I was very quickly uncovered. So I've been at large in the blogging community for about 3 years now.
What sorts of things were you covering in the blog?
It actually tends to be quite a narrow area of science. We look at total synthesis, and if somebody comes very close to finishing the synthesis of a natural product but doesn't finish it, then we don't cover it. Only ever look at completed syntheses. And occasionally, if there's something very interesting or dramatic in the organic chemistry community, we'll look at that too, because of course it's of interest to our scientists working in natural products as much as anybody else.
And when you say you look at it, do you mean you try to dismantle what they've done and work out if they got it right?
We do very little error correction. We tend to just look at recent syntheses published in the top journals and dismantle the thought process behind what they did, and trying to understand whether their approach was the most obvious one or whether they've really thought about things in a very lateral sense.
Who reads this?
I've tried to look at statistics on this, and I would say there's probably a 50-50 split between academics and people working in industry. Though I would say it does lend itself more towards a younger audience of a lot of PhD students or chemists starting out in their career in industry.
So tell us about how you got into your latest foray, critiquing, let's say, an interesting bit of research that's been done recently.
I was actually alerted to this paper published in the Journal of the American Chemical Society after some of my readers posted comments and suggested that this paper might contain some really interesting chemistry. The lead author is David Wang of the School of Chemistry at Peking University, and his team have worked on an approach of oxidizing alcohols using sodium hydride. And the counterintuitive step is that sodium hydride is a reductant, so one would expect the opposite to occur. So they were using a reducing agent to do an oxidation.
This was in a peer-reviewed journal, so presumably they managed to satisfy the review process that what they had to say was at least plausible.
Yeah, I think if there's no doubt that chemistry was done and they used the right approach to doing the chemistry. I just think that the conclusions they came to and the rationale, which is given in a mechanism to try and understand how this chemical process might occur, it's hard to understand how they could come to this conclusion.
So what did you do about it?
Well, unlike a lot of other papers in organic chemistry, the starting materials, the raw compounds they were working with, they're very common, and I guessed that we might have some in our small chemical store. And within a couple of minutes, I had a representative example. And the technique they use is really simple. And I must admit that the reaction was going on before I thought, hang on, is this a good idea? But by that point, I'd started writing about it, and I've been posting pictures of the reactions and the what I'd actually conducted in the lab in my blog.
So what conclusion did you reach, and did you agree with them or not?
After leaving the reaction for exactly the right amount of time and doing things exactly as they suggested should be done, I have to conclude that the reaction does work, but only if one allows atmosphere into the reaction. In other words, you're allowing oxygen into the reaction. It's hard to say exactly what role oxygen or perhaps even water could be playing in the reaction, but it seems very clear that it is necessary.
So in other words, if you conduct this and you do it without allowing any room air or at least oxygen to penetrate the reaction mixture, it doesn't work. But if you do allow room air in, it does work. How did you find that out?
I didn't take the most stringent approach to keeping out oxygen, and I saw a little of the reaction happening. Some of my commenters, who at this point had started to conduct the reactions themselves, and some of them work in inorganic chemistry, and these guys I have a lot of respect for because they're really good at keeping reactions anhydrous and anaerobic. And when they tried that, they saw no reaction whatsoever. But then when they let the atmosphere in, the reaction went beautifully.
What do you think the bigger implication of this is for people who are publishing chemical syntheses like this?
It's telling us that perhaps the authors should have tried a different range of reaction conditions. Perhaps they should have tried deliberately pumping oxygen into the reaction, or tried using equipment that allowed them to be far more stringent. And maybe then they would have come to the conclusion that I've come to, which is that you do need atmosphere in the reaction.
Don't you think it's amazing, though, that without the internet and without your blog, we've now got a sort of a stage beyond peer review. We've now got blog-level peer review, which is putting researchers like you onto interesting things and then getting you looking at them in a new way and finding novel things about them, even catching people out.
I think one of the most useful things was that we're able to draw some new conclusions very quickly. I think within 48 hours, the reactions were all done, the results were there for people to read. But I think very important to this was that everybody knew who I was. If I'd been anonymous at this point, I could have been saying anything because it wouldn't have affected my career. The fact that the blog is identified as being owned by me brings some credibility to the results.
Indeed, and it's a process that's taking peer review to a whole new level beyond just the publication of the piece of research. That was Paul Docherty, who's a medicinal chemist at Arrow Therapeutics in the UK. And if you want to check out his blog, it's online at totallysynthetic.com/blog. You're listening to Chemistry World with me, Chris Smith. And still to come, how computers are helping us to predict what the flu will do, why drug discovery could be set to take off in a big way in South Africa, and the origins of methane on Mars. Martians or just marsh gas? But first, Tom, to the nano equivalent of flypaper for bacteria.
Yeah, so this is a study that's just been published by a group in Spain, in Tarragona, led by Javier Rios and Jordi Riu. And what they've done is created some sticky nanotubes which can trap bacteria like flypaper.
Go on, so tell us, what are these? What's the anatomy of these nanotubes, first of all?
They're comprised of carbon nanotubes which are coated in aptamers, which are, well, they can be made from a variety of genetic material. They're just short sections, but in this case they're made from RNA and they're able to bind specifically to different types of target molecules, in this case a bacteria, so the aptamer is specific for one type of bacteria.
So presumably what happens is that the aptamer binds onto the surface of a bacteria selectively so that you can register the presence of a certain type of bacteria specifically.
Yeah, that's correct. And at the moment, it's the aptamer is just selective for one type of bacteria, which is the Salmonella typhi, which causes typhoid. But in the future, they hope to be able to create other aptamers which are selected for different types of bacteria. And the mechanism by which they tell how many bacteria are present is that when the aptamer is bound to the bacteria, it peels away from the nanotube, and this causes a change in conductivity, which can be linked to the number of bacteria present.
Okay, so they're putting a sort of electric charge across the base of the field of nanotubes, are they? So you can then see how the current changes when there's binding of the bacteria.
Yeah, it's effectively a conductivity measurement, but yeah.
Are they easy to make? In other words, is this practical? Do you think we could see this on sale as a nano detector in the near future?
I think they're probably fairly easy to make. The limitations at present seem to be that you need to have the specific aptamer to bind to the targeted bacteria, and also just the cost of the carbon nanotubes. So those are probably the limited factors at present. But in the future, the study hopes that cost of carbon nanotubes will come down and make it more feasible.
Well, let's hope so. I mean, it sounds like an amazing technology, actually, and certainly quicker than trying to grow these things in culture to work out what they are, which is the present way of doing it, which takes time.
Yeah, that seems to be the major benefit, is it's much quicker, so it can potentially even in real time or in the hospital rather than over days, as current methods would take.
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, certainly a fascinating piece of research, and I will hopefully maybe look forward to seeing that in my lab in the near future. Now, let's move from something pretty small detecting bacteria to something even smaller, but still a microbe, viruses, and one that's a particular pain at the moment, Matt, and that's the flu. Tell us about this.
Yes, Chris. Researchers from Stanford University in California, led by Peter Kassan, have been developing a way of predicting the most virulent types of form. And to find out which are going to be the most infectious in the future.
Obviously a big question, because flu is a moving target, it's continuously mutating and changing. We've also got new jumps of new viruses out of birds and into other animals, including humans. We're always playing catch-up. We're trying to work out how to make vaccines and so on, rather than preempting these things. Are you saying that researchers are now able to look forwards and they'll be able to preempt basically what a strain that's going to emerge is going to be like?
Well, that's what they're trying to do, and this is really, and they caution themselves that actually this is one of the first steps towards it. What they've done is they've started studying the hemagglutinin protein, which binds to the sugars on the outside of host cells, and the strength of that binding is actually responsible for how infectious a type of flu will be. And so in this example, they've taken the X-ray crystal structure of an avian flu hemagglutinin protein bound to an avian sugar. And from that data, they've then gone on and done molecular dynamic computational chemistry experiments and combined that with protein sequence data to pinpoint the exact mutations that could lead to, that could impact on the strength of that binding interaction.
I see. So now what you're saying is we have a computer model that can work out what mutations we would need to look for to predict if something that we see out there in the environment is likely to be nasty or not. In other words, how infectious it's likely to be for us.
Exactly. By making different mutations in those different points, they can predict whether it is less, more or less infectious. Of course, what they can't tell us is how nasty that's going to be. We all know that swine flu at the moment is very infectious, but actually at the moment it's not that deadly.
Have they actually road tested it? I mean, obviously they've used various interactions. You've said they've used H5N1 as an example, but have they actually then said, right, let's put this to the test. We've got this model. Let's anticipate a few changes and then make a virus with these changes in it and see if what their model says should happen is mirrored when you test that virus.
Well, they've had a little bit of a look, but unfortunately, there's not that much data out there yet. They've even gone back to the 1918 Spanish flu, which was again a swine flu type thing, and looked at how that affected it. But unfortunately, there's just not that much data out there of this type yet. So they're hoping that more people will collect more data, and then we'll be able to go on and build a bigger bank of data so we can actually predict what flu is going to be attacking us next.
I thought you were going to say for a minute more people will get flu and then we can study what happened to them and then refine the model that way. But this is certainly looking like it's going to be a very important tool because it means that we can begin to ask those kinds of questions and then also look forward rather than back.
Yes, Chris.
Time will tell, I guess, but it certainly sounds like a powerful tool. Thank you, Matt. Drug discovery is big business, but it's something that, until very recently, has remained firmly rooted in the developed world. But now an organic chemist at the University of Cape Town is on a mission to change all that, and in the process to bring some pharmaceutical prosperity to South Africa. His name, Kelly Chibali.
What I'm trying to do at the University of Cape Town is set up a drug discovery centre specifically focusing on integrating drug metabolism and pharmacokinetics into medicinal chemistry.
So just explain for a minute what the motivation of doing this is. Why does South Africa need to do this? What does it hope to gain by doing it?
The motivation really behind this is the government is really trying to put in place measures to catalyze biotechnology in the country. And I think one of the areas that is really being looked at is the country playing a very important role in solving the health problems that affect not just the country, but the rest of the continent.
I suppose one area or one way of looking at this is the fact that most of the world, when they invent something, they then license it to the rest of the world, and that's a revenue stream. And I suppose that South Africa is very well placed to do a lot of the primary research, to get something patentable, license that to other African countries, but also beyond Africa, the rest of the world, and that then gives South Africa a revenue stream.
Absolutely. Even big companies don't necessarily take things from discovery all the way through to the clinic. But whether they go all the way and develop a drug, or at least license it, they add a lot of value to it so that they can be able to recoup a lot of the costs that we put into the research, including having a very long-term sustainable revenue source.
It sounds, Kelly, rather like a no-brainer. It sounds like an obvious thing to do. Why hasn't South Africa done this already?
Because of what happened for a long time during the apartheid era, the country was basically isolated from the rest of the world. So the know-how might have been there, but this is something that you don't necessarily do by yourself, that you have to tap into other technologies elsewhere. And because most of the companies, the pharmaceutical companies, actually pulled out of the country, there was never an opportunity to develop a base in this area. The biggest challenge to successful drug discovery and development, the major stumbling block, is actually what the body does to the drug. In other words, so this is a term we refer to as pharmacokinetics. So what the body does to the drug is, in fact, the major stumbling block. So the key missing ingredient in South Africa is to be able to allow, at a very early stage, the drug metabolism of magnetic studies to be able to guide the chemistry, the medicinal chemistry. You modify your chemical structure of the potential drug in such a way as to be able to address any liabilities or shortcomings to do with metabolism. So that has really has been a missing puzzle in South Africa. And I mean, we think that this center that I'm setting up is uniquely positioned to deliver that very key missing ingredient.
Now, a lot of Western drug companies are under considerable pressure to make available some of their lead compounds, which they sell for a lot of money in the West, to countries in, say, the African continent, where there are chronic diseases like HIV, where these sorts of medications can make a life or death difference. That means that there might be a pressure on you to make your compounds available in the same way. So how will you respond to that?
I do understand why drugs are so expensive. That it's a very expensive process, very risky. And I think that the companies have to recoup some of that profit, some of that money. So that I think that when it comes to people putting pressure on companies to lower the cost of research, is I think one of the ways that our center will get around that problem is first of all, that the cost of doing the research itself will be, I think, a fraction of what one would pay to do the same research in the Western world. So naturally, the amount of money that will have to go into that discovery and development will be lower compared to what one would put into a similar program in the West. the pricing of any potential drugs that come out of this will be quite competitive. And of course, the fact that some of the research programs and efforts will be government supported, there will be some level of subsidy, if you like, in terms of offsetting some of the costs for drug discovery and development.
When do you see this actually coming to fruition, where your unit is actually churning out compounds or has actually uncovered potential drug leads that you could then license on?
One of the partners for this platform is Medicine for Malaria Venture. And we have an agreement right now in terms of speeding up the process of coming up with potential leads within a few years, is basically to tap into a number of high-throughput screening programs that MMV, Medicines for Malaria Venture, are actually funding in terms of screening potentially thousands, hundreds of thousands of small molecules that are being made available partly from pharmaceutical companies and partly from other organizations. So basically we're starting at quite a high level from that perspective, so that I think within a few years, and I'm talking about 3-4 years, we should be able to deliver quality leads within 3 years that will be ready to go into preclinical and potentially licensing at that stage.
So things are moving on apace, and you can read more about his work and drug development in the developing world in a special feature in this month's print edition of Chemistry World. Now, from Chemistry World to another world entirely, and there's been some more tantalising news from Saturn's moon Enceladus, which scientists discovered a few years back to be periodically producing a giant geyser, or should that be geyser, which jets material out into space and even makes one of Saturn's rings. So what's come to light now, Matt?
Well, Chris, there's been a big question as to whether there are large lakes of unfrozen water near Enceladus's south pole. There are big plumes of gas and water discharged from the south pole of Enceladus, forming what some would call the solar system's largest geyser.
So this is material which just gets periodically jetted up into space, thousands of kilometres. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think in recent months, actually, scientists have been looking at this quite closely because they want to know what the composition is, to know whether or not there's liquid water on the surface of the moon.
Yes, indeed, Chris. A couple of months ago, there was a couple of papers published in Nature looking at that water once it had ended up as Saturn's outer ring, and one of the studies found that in amongst the water there were high levels of sodium chloride, and that would indicate that or higher levels of sodium chloride than you would find in frozen water or ice, indicating that actually there are big lakes underneath the frozen surface of Enceladus. Now, the most recent studies have been conducted by a flyby of the Cassini probe, which have actually gone through the plumes themselves. And they've done five flybys through these plumes. And the last one had such good signal-to-noise ratios that not only could they find the water and carbon dioxide that was emitted, but they could also find a range of organic molecules and other gases as well.
What did they find?
Well, the biggest contaminant, if you will, was actually benzene. But after that, they found a high concentration of ammonia. And this is particularly important because ammonia acts as an antifreeze type molecule, which makes it even more likely that underneath the surface of the frozen crust, there could well be lakes of unfrozen water.
Which, of course, is a prerequisite, we think, for there being life, possibly. What else was in the plume?
There was also a high concentration of argon-40. Now, argon-40 is the radio degradation, is the radioactive degradation product of potassium-40. And the researchers believe that the high concentrations are too high to be found just from the ambient argon-40 found in the universe. And they believe it's down to this breakdown of potassium-40 that would have been found in rocks. Now, if it was ice all the way through to the rocks, you wouldn't get the leaching from the rock into the water. And if they've got lakes, then you would get leaching into the water, and then that argon-40 could be expelled quite easily into these plumes.
Oh, I see. So you get water leaching the potassium-40. This then breaks down in the water to turn into argon and gets spat out, which is why you see this artificially high level of argon, because there must be liquid water washing around on the surface to do that leaching.
Exactly, Chris.
How solid is this? I mean, How are we going to sort this out?
It's a particularly difficult problem to study. Each little bit of evidence gives us another idea as to what's going on. Until we can really send people out there, it's going to be tricky to find it. But it's going to be a cold and not particularly pleasant holiday for anybody in the near future.
Certainly an interesting one. Thank you, Matt. Now, Phil, sticking with space, but to another world, bit bigger, Mars this time, but also with a mystery, and it's a methane mystery.
Yes, Chris, that's absolutely right. Well, in 2003, some researchers found that there is methane on the surface of Mars. Earlier this year, Michael Mummer and some guys from NASA found that far from being uniform, the distribution of methane across the planet was localised in hotspots.
What do they say is the implication of that?
Well, these hotspots vary locally and seasonally, and that can't be explained by standard models. So what Frank Lefebvre and François Forget have done at the Pierre and Marie Curie University in Paris is developed a whole new atmospheric model for methane on Mars, coupling in some different forms of chemistry.
But what was the big problem with the fact? Why can't you have methane building up and making a hotspot somewhere?
Well, if you consider that the only way of getting rid of methane on Mars is by photochemical degradation by sunlight, it should have a half-life of centuries, which would allow it to distribute over the surface evenly.
I see, so you should get an even layer rather than these focal hotspots. So if you've got focal hotspots, that must say either that it's being produced where the hotspots are very, very fast, or broken down everywhere else very, very fast.
Exactly, or even both, because what the French researchers have found is that there are chemistry models consistent with breaking down that methane very quickly if you have very oxidizing molecules in the soil, such as perchlorates, then you can have a half-life in the region of a year, which is about 600 times faster than by photochemical degradation.
How does this sit with the claim that this methane might be coming out seasonally and from hotspots because it's biogenic, it's being made by life? Does this scupper that or does it strengthen that claim?
Well, it's absolutely consistent, Chris, because if you've got that methane being destroyed 600 times as fast, then it must also be being created 600 times as fast to maintain the same levels. And that's perfectly consistent with it being created by life, that it would just mean that life would have to be slightly further below the surface to be protected from this oxidizing surface of this oxidizing chemistry on the surface that's destroying the methane.
And speaking of that, does the chemistry actually stack up in terms of what is being predicted and what these people are suggesting as the way in which the methane could be being consumed?
Well, Chris, given that the only data that we've got about the surface of Mars is from the Mars landings, which certainly haven't covered the whole surface, it's perfectly feasible that there are these hotspots which have completely different surface composition that haven't been seen before.
My money's on the Martians doing it, but it may not be life as we know it. I guess we'll have to wait a few years to find out. Thank you, Phil. Right, well, that's pretty much it for this month. But before we go, we'd better catch up with the answer to our chemical conundrum from last time. So please, Matt, remind us of the question.
Last month, our chemical conundrum had another space theme and was linked to the anniversary of the Apollo moon landings. We asked what was the key bit of data collected by the astronauts which supported the theory that the moon was formed when Earth and another planet had a massive collision as the solar system was forming.
And the answer was the oxygen isotope data. Moon rocks brought back by the astronauts show that this ratio is identical on the moon and the Earth, so they must have formed from the same original material.
So you're not a conspiracy theorist then?
Absolutely not, Chris. It's science all the way.
And conspiracy theories aside, this month's question is to do with brain chemistry. Now, scientists studying the brain have discovered a way to erase fearful memories, in rats at least. But how have they done it? If you'd like a clue, you might want to check out the story on the Chemistry World blog, which you can find at www.chemistryworld.org/blog.
And the incentive, of course, Matt. It's always important to mention that. What are they going to win, Phil?
Well, you'll win the famous Chemistry World goodie bag. You should email your answers to chemistryworld@rsc.org. And don't forget to include your name and address so that we know where to send the prize.
Indeed, and you can, of course, use that address to send us your thoughts, feedback or suggestions for future episodes. That's it for this month, and for me, in fact, that's it for a little while. I won't be with you now until the new year, so have a very nice Christmas in the meantime. While I'm away, Meera Senthilingam, who normally produces this podcast for us, will be picking up the reins. So thank you to her for doing that. Our contributors this month were Matt Wilkinson, Phil Broadwith, Tom Bond and Nina Notman. And I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientist.com. Thank you for listening, and until next time, goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.